turned his head and addressed someone standing off camera.
"Think I ought to have brought my lawyers?"
The interviewer brayed with sycophantic laughter. DB looked back at him, still unsmiling.
"DB Mack," said the breathless interviewer, "thank you very much for your time."
An outstretched white hand slid forwards onto the screen. DB raised his own in a fist. The white hand reconstituted itself, and they bumped knuckles. Somebody off-screen laughed derisively. The video ended.
"The motherfucking press chased her out that window," Stripe repeated, rolling his chair back into its original position. "Interesting point of view."
He felt his mobile phone vibrate in his trouser pocket and drew it out. The sight of Charlotte's name attached to a new text caused a surge of adrenaline through his body, as though he had just sighted a crouching beast of prey.
"I will be out on Friday morning between 9 and 12 if you want to collect your things."
"What?"
He had the impression that Robin had just spoken.
"I said there's a horrible piece here about her birth mother."
"Okay, read it out."
He slid his mobile back into his pocket. As he bent his large head again over Mrs. Hook's file, his thoughts seemed to reverberate as though a gong had been struck inside his skull. Charlotte was behaving with sinister reasonableness, feigning adult calm. She had taken their endlessly elaborate duel to a new level, never before reached or tested.
"Now let's do it like grown-ups."
Perhaps a knife would plunge between his shoulder blades as he walked through the front door of her flat. Perhaps he would walk into the bedroom to discover her corpse, wrists slit, lying in a puddle of congealing blood in front of the fireplace. Robin's voice was like the background drone of a vacuum cleaner. With an effort, he refocused his attention. "So the romantic story of her liaison with a young black man to as many tabloid journalists as were prepared to pay. There is nothing romantic, however, about Marlene Higson's story as it is remembered by her old neighbours." "She was turning tricks," says Vivian Cranfield, who lived in the flat above Higson's at the time she fell pregnant with Landry. "There were men coming in and out of her place every hour of the day and night. She never knew who that baby's father was. It could have been any of them. She never wanted the baby. I can still remember her out in the hall, crying on her own, while her mum was busy with a punter. Tiny little thing in a nappy, hardly walking. Someone must have called social services, and not before time. Best thing that ever happened to that girl, getting adopted." The truth will no doubt shock Landry, who has talked at length in the press about her reunion with her long-lost birth mother. "This was written," explained Robin, "before Lula died."
"Yeah," said Strike, closing the folder abruptly. "Do you fancy a walk?"
Chapter 2 The cameras looked like malevolent shoeboxes atop their pole, each with a single blank black eye. They pointed in opposite directions, staring the length of Alderbrook Road, which bustled with pedestrians and traffic. Both pavements were crammed with shops, bars and cafes. Double-deckers rumbled up and down bus lanes.
"This is where Bristow's runner was caught on film," observed Strike,
turning his back on Alderbrook Road to look up the much quieter Bellamy Road, which led, lined with tall and palatial houses, into the residential heart of Mayfair.
"He passed here 12 minutes after she fell. This'd be the quickest route from Kentigern Gardens. Night buses run here. Best bet to pick up a taxi. Not that that'd be a smart move if you'd just murdered a woman."
He buried himself again in an extremely battered A to Z. Strike did not seem worried that anyone might mistake him for a tourist. No doubt, thought Robin, it would not matter if they did, given his size. Robin had been asked to do several things in the course of her brief temping career that were outside the terms of a secretarial contract, and had therefore been a little unnerved by Strike's suggestion of a walk. She was pleased, however, to acquit Strike of any flirtatious intent. The long walk to this spot had been conducted in almost total silence, Strike apparently deep in thought, and occasionally consulting his map. Upon their arrival in Alderbrook Road, however, he had said,
"If you spot anything, or you think of anything I haven't, tell me, won't you?"
This was rather thrilling. Robin prided herself on her observational powers. They were one reason she had secretly cherished the childhood ambition that the large man beside her was living. She looked intelligently up and down the street, and tried to visualize what someone might have been up to on a snowy night in sub-zero temperatures at 2 in the morning.
"This way," said Strike, however, before any insights could occur to her,
and they walked off, side by side, along Bellamy Road. It curved gently to the left and continued for some 60 houses, which were almost identical, with their glossy black doors, their short railings either side of clean white steps, and their topiary-filled tubs. Here and there were marble lions and brass plaques, giving names and professional credentials. Chandeliers glinted from upper windows, and one door stood open to reveal a checkerboard floor, oil paintings in gold frames, and a Georgian staircase. As he walked, Strike pondered some of the information that Robin had managed to find on the internet that morning. As Strike had suspected, Bristow had not been honest when he asserted that the police had made no effort to trace the runner and his sidekick. Buried in voluminous and rabid press coverage that survived online were appeals for the men to come forward, but they seemed to have yielded no results. Unlike Bristow, Strike did not find any of this suggestive of police incompetence or of a plausible murder suspect left uninvestigated. The sudden sounding of a car alarm around the time that the two men had fled the area suggested a good reason for their reluctance to talk to the police. Moreover, Strike did not know whether Bristow was familiar with the varying quality of CCTV footage, but he himself had extensive experience of frustrating, blurry black-and-white images from which it was impossible to glean a true likeness. Strike had also noticed that Bristow had said not a word in person or in his notes about the DNA evidence gathered from inside his sister's flat. He strongly suspected, from the fact that the police had been happy to exclude the runner and his friend from further inquiries, that no trace of foreign DNA had been found there. However, Strike knew that the truly deluded would happily discount such trivialities as DNA evidence, citing contamination or conspiracy. They saw what they wanted to see, blind to inconvenient, implacable truth. But the Google searches of the morning had suggested a possible explanation for Bristow's fixation on the runner. His sister had been researching her biological roots and had managed to trace her birth mother, who sounded, even when allowance was made for press sensationalism, an unsavoury character. Doubtless revelations such as those that Robin had found online would have been unpleasant not just for Landry, but for her whole adoptive family. Was it part of Bristow's instability? For Strike could not pretend to himself that his client gave the impression of a well-balanced man, that he believed Lula, so fortunate in some ways, had tempted fate. That she had stirred up trouble in trying to plumb the secrets of her origins. That she had woken a demon that had reached out of the distant past and killed her. Was that why a black man in her vicinity so disturbed him? Deeper and deeper into the enclave of the wealthy, Strike and Robin walked, until they arrived at the corner of Kentigern Gardens. Like Bellamy Road, it projected an aura of intimidating, self-contained prosperity. The houses here were high Victorian red brick, with stone dressings and heavy pedimented windows on 4 floors, with their own small stone balconies. White marble porticos framed each entrance, and 3 white steps led from the pavement to more glossy black front doors. Everything was expensively well-maintained, clean and regimented. There were only a few cars parked here. A small sign declared that permits were needed for the privilege. No longer set apart by police tape and massing journalists, number 18 had faded back into graceful conformity with its neighbours.
"The balcony she fell from was on the top floor," said Strike. "About 40 feet up, I'd say."
He contemplated a handsome frontage. The balconies on the top three floors, Robin saw, were shallow, with barely standing room between the balustrade and the long windows.
"The thing is," Stripe told Robin, while he squinted at the balcony high above them, "pushing someone from that height wouldn't guarantee death."
"Oh, but surely," protested Robin, contemplating the awful drop between top balcony and hard road.
"You'd be surprised. I spent a month in a bed next to a Welsh bloke who got blown off a building about that height. Smashed his legs and pelvis. Lot of internal bleeding, but he's still with us."
Robin glanced at Strike, wondering why he had been in bed for a month. But the detective was oblivious, now scowling at the front door.
"Keypad," he muttered,
noting the metal square inset with buttons,
"and a camera over the door. Bristow didn't mention a camera. Could be new."
He stood for a few minutes testing theories against the intimidating red brick face of these fantastically expensive fortresses. Why had Lula Landry chosen to live here in the first place? Sedate, traditional, stuffy, Kentigern Gardens was surely the natural domain of a different kind of rich. Russian and Arab oligarchs, corporate giants splitting their time between town and their country estates, wealthy spinsters slowly decaying amidst their art collections. He found it a strange choice of abode for a girl of 23, who ran, according to every story Robin had read out that morning, with a hip, creative crowd whose celebrated sense of style owed more to the street than the salon.
"It looks very well protected, doesn't it?"
said Robin.
"Yeah, it does. And that's without the crowd of paparazzi who were standing guard over it that night."
Strike leaned back against the black railings of number 23, staring at number 18. The windows of Landry's former residence were taller than those on the lower floors, and its balcony, unlike the other two, had not been decorated with topiary shrubs. Strike slipped a packet of cigarettes out of his pocket and offered Robin one. She shook her head, surprised, because she had not seen him smoke in the office. Having lit up and inhaled deeply, he said, with his eyes on the front door,
"Bristow thinks someone got in and out that night, undetected."
Robin, who had already decided that the building was impenetrable, thought that Strike was about to pour scorn on the theory, but she was wrong.
"If they did," said Strike, eyes still on the door, "it was planned and planned well. Nobody could have got past photographers, a keypad, a security guard, and a closed inner door, and out again, on luck alone. Thing is," he scratched his chin, "that degree of premeditation doesn't fit with such a slapdash murder."
Robin found the choice of adjective callous.
"Pushing someone over a balcony is a spur-of-the-moment thing," said Strike, as though he had felt her inner wince. "Hot blood. Blind temper."
He found Robin's company satisfactory and restful, not only because she was hanging off his every word and had not troubled to break his silences, but because that little sapphire ring on her third finger was like a neat full stop, this far and no further. It suited him perfectly. He was free to show off in a very mild way, which was one of the few pleasures remaining to him. But what if the killer was already inside?
"That's a lot more plausible," said Strike, and Robin felt very pleased with herself. "And if a killer was already in there, we've got the choice between the security guard himself, one or both of the bestiguis, or some unknown person who was hiding in the building without anyone's knowledge. If it was either of the bestiguis or Wilson, there's no getting in and out problem. All they had to do was return to the places they were supposed to be. There was still the risk she could have survived, injured to tell the tale. But a hot-blooded, unpremeditated crime makes a lot more sense if one of them did it. A row and a blind shove."
Strike smoked his cigarette and continued to scrutinize the front of the building, in particular the gap between the windows on the first floor and those on the third. He was thinking primarily about Freddie Bestigui, the film producer. According to what Robin had found on the internet, Bastigui had been in bed asleep when Lula Landry toppled over the balcony two floors above. The fact that it was Bastigui's own wife who had sounded the alarm and insisted that the killer was still upstairs while her husband stood beside her implied that she, at least, did not think him guilty. Nevertheless, Freddy Bastigui had been the man in closest proximity to the dead girl at the time of her death. Laymen, in Strike's experience, were obsessed with motive. Opportunity, top of the professional's list. Unwittingly confirming her civilian status, Robin said, "But why would someone pick the middle of the night to have an argument with her? Nothing ever came out about her not getting on with her neighbours, did it? And Tansy Bastigui definitely couldn't have done it, could she? Why would she run downstairs and tell the security guard if she'd just pushed Lula over the balcony?" Strike did not answer directly. He seemed to be following his own train of thought, and after a moment or two replied, "Bristow's fixated on the quarter of an hour after his sister went inside, after the photographers had left and the security guard had abandoned the desk because he was ill. That meant the lobby became briefly navigable. But how was anyone outside the building supposed to know that Wilson had left his post? The front door is not made of glass." "Plus," interjected Robin intelligently, "they'd have needed to know the key code to open the front door." "People get slack. Unless the security people change it regularly, loads of undesirables could have known that code. Let's have a look down here." They walked in silence right to the end of Kentigern Gardens, where they found a narrow alleyway which ran, at a slightly oblique angle, along the rear of Landry's block of houses. Strike was amused to note that the alley was called Surf's Way. Wide enough to allow a single car to pass, it had plentiful lighting and was devoid of hiding places, with long, high, smooth walls on either side of the cobbled passageway. They came in due course to a pair of large, electrically operated garage doors, with an enormous private sign affixed to the wall beside them, which guarded the entrance to the underground cache of parking spaces for the Kentigern gardeners. When he judged that they were roughly level with the back of number 18, Strike made a leap, caught hold of the top of the wall, and heaved himself up to look into a long row of small, carefully manicured gardens. Between each patch of smooth and well-tended lawn and the house to which it belonged was a shadowy stairwell to basement level. Anyone wishing to climb the rear of the house would, in Strike's opinion, require ladders or a partner to belay him and some sturdy ropes. He let himself slide back down the wall, emitting a stifled grunt of pain as he landed on the prosthetic leg.
"It's nothing," he said,
when Robin made a concerned noise. She had noticed the vestige of a limp and wondered whether he had sprained an ankle. The chafing on the end of the stump was not helped by hobbling off over the cobbles. It was much harder, given the rigid construction of his false ankle, to navigate uneven surfaces. Strike asked himself ruefully whether he had really needed to hoist himself up on the wall at all. Robin might be a pretty girl, but she could not hold a candle to the woman he had just left. Chapter 3.
"And you're sure he's a detective, are you? Because anyone can do that. Anyone can Google people."
Matthew was irritable after a long day, a disgruntled client and an unsatisfactory encounter with his new boss. He did not appreciate what struck him as naive and misplaced admiration for another man on the part of his fiancée.
"He wasn't Googling people," said Robin. "I was the one doing the Googling while he was working on another case."
"Well, I don't like the sound of the setup. He's sleeping in his office, Robin. Don't you think there's something a bit fishy there?"
"I told you. I think he's just split up with his partner."
"Yeah, I'll bet he has," said Matthew.
Robin dropped his plate down on top of her own and stalked off into the kitchen. She was angry at Matthew and vaguely annoyed with Strike, too. She had enjoyed tracking Lula Landry's acquaintance across cyberspace that day, but seeing it retrospectively through Matthew's eyes, it seemed to her that Strike had given her a pointless, time-filling job.
"Look, I'm not saying anything," Matthew said,
from the kitchen doorway. I just think he sounds weird. And what's with the little afternoon walks?
It wasn't a little afternoon walk, Matt. We went to see the scene of the... We went to see the place where the client thinks something happened.
Robin, there's no need to make such a bloody mystery about it, Matthew laughed.
I've signed a confidentiality agreement, she snapped over her shoulder. I can't tell you about the case.
The case?
He gave another short, scoffing laugh.
Robin strode around the tiny kitchen, putting away ingredients, slamming cupboard doors.
After a while, watching her figure as she moved around, Matthew came to feel that he might have been unreasonable. He came up behind her as she was scraping the leftovers into the bin, put his arms around her, buried his face in her neck, and cupped and stroked the breast that bore the bruises Strike had accidentally inflicted, and which had irrevocably coloured Matthew's view of the man. He murmured conciliatory phrases into Robin's honey-coloured hair, but she pulled away from him to put the plates into the sink. Robin felt as though her own worth had been impugned. Strike had seemed interested in the things she had found online. Strike expressed gratitude for her efficiency and initiative.
"How many proper interviews have you got next week?" Matthew asked, as she turned on the cold tap.
"Three!"
she shouted over the noise of the gushing water, scrubbing the top plate aggressively. She waited until he had walked away into the sitting room before turning off the tap. There was, she noticed, a fragment of frozen pea caught in the setting of her engagement ring.
Chapter 4
Strike arrived at Charlotte's flat at 9:30 on Friday morning. This gave her, he reasoned, half an hour to be well clear of the place before he entered it, assuming that she really was intending to leave, rather than lie in wait for him. The grand and gracious white buildings that lined the wide street, the plane trees, the butcher's shop that might have been stuck in the 1950s, the cafes bustling with the upper middle classes, the sleek restaurants, they had always felt slightly unreal and stagey to Strike. Perhaps he had always known, deep down, that he would not stay, that he did not belong. Until the moment he unlocked the front door, he expected her to be there. Yet as soon as he stepped over the threshold, he knew that the place was empty. The silence had that slack quality that speaks only of the indifference of uninhabited rooms, and his footsteps sounded alien and overloud as he made his way down the hall. Four cardboard boxes stood in the middle of the sitting room, open for him to inspect. Here were his cheap and serviceable belongings, heaped together like jumble sale objects. He lifted a few things up to check the deeper levels, but nothing seemed to have been smashed, ripped, or covered in paint. Other people his age had houses and washing machines, cars and television sets, furniture and gardens and mountain bikes and lawnmowers. He had four boxes of crap and a set of matchless memories. The silent room in which he stood spoke of a confident good taste, with its antique rug and its pale flesh-pink walls, its fine darkwood furniture and its overflowing bookcases. The only change he spotted since Sunday night stood on the glass end table beside the sofa. On Sunday night there had been a picture of himself and Charlotte laughing on the beach at St. Maur's. Now a black-and-white studio portrait of Charlotte's dead father smiled benignly at Strike from the same silver picture frame. Over the mantelpiece hung a portrait of an 18-year-old Charlotte in oils. It showed the face of a Florentine angel in a cloud of long dark hair. Hers was the kind of family that commissioned painters to immortalize its young, a background utterly alien to Strike, and one he had come to know like a dangerous foreign country. From Charlotte, he had learned that the kind of money he had never known could coexist with unhappiness and savagery. Her family, for all their gracious manners, their suavity and flair, their erudition and occasional flamboyance, was even madder and stranger than his own. That had been a powerful link between them when first he and Charlotte had come together. A strange, stray thought came to him now. as he looked up at that portrait, that this was the reason it had been painted, so that one day its large hazel-green eyes would watch him leave. Had Charlotte known what it would feel like to prowl the empty flat under the eyes of her stunning 18-year-old self? Had she realized that the painting would do her work better than her physical presence? He turned away, striding through the other rooms, but she had left nothing for him to do. Every trace of him, from his tooth floss to his army boots, had been taken and deposited in the boxes. He studied the bedroom with particular attention, and the room looked back at him, with its dark floorboards, white curtains, and delicate dressing table, calm and composed. The bed, like the portrait, seemed a living, breathing presence. "Remember what happened here, and what can never happen again." He carried the four boxes one by one out onto the doorstep, on the last trip, coming face to face with the smirking next-door neighbour who was locking his own front door. He wore rugby shirts with the collars turned up, and always brayed with panting laughter at Charlotte's lightest witticisms.
"Having a clear-out?" he asked.
Strike shut Charlotte's door firmly on him. He slid the door keys off his keyring in front of the hall mirror and laid them carefully on the half-moon table next to the bowl of potpourri. Strike's face in the glass was creviced and dirty-looking, his right eye still puffy, yellow and mauve. A voice from 17 years before came to him in the silence.
"How the fuck did a pew-bedded trog like you ever pull that, Strike?"
And it seemed incredible that he ever had, as he stood there in the hall, he would never see again. One last moment of madness, the space between heartbeats, like the one that had sent him hurtling after her 5 days previously. He would stay here after all, waiting for her to return, then cupping her perfect face in his hands and saying, "Let's try again." But they had already tried again and again and again, and always when the first crashing wave of mutual longing subsided, the ugly wreck of the past lay revealed again, its shadow lying darkly over everything they tried to rebuild. He closed the front door behind him for the last time. The braying neighbour had vanished. Strike lifted the four boxes down the steps onto the pavement and waited to hail a black cab. Chapter 5. Strike had told Robin that he would be late into the office on her last morning. He had given her the spare key and told her to let herself in. She had been very slightly hurt by his casual use of the word last. It told her that however well they had got along, albeit in a guarded and professional way, however much more organized his office was, and how much cleaner the horrible washroom outside the glass door, however much better the bell downstairs looked without that scrappy piece of paper taped beneath it, but a neatly typed name in the clear plastic holder, it had taken her half an hour and cost her 2 broken nails to prise the cover off. However efficient she had been at taking messages, however intelligently she had discussed the almost certainly non-existent killer of Lula Landry, Strike had been counting down the days until he could get rid of her. That he could not afford a temporary secretary was perfectly obvious. He had only 2 clients. He seemed, as Matthew kept mentioning, as though sleeping in an office was a mark of terrible depravity, to be homeless. Robin saw, of course, that from Strike's point of view, it made no sense to keep her on. But she was not looking forward to Monday. There would be a strange new office. Temporary Solutions had already telephoned through the address. A neat, bright, bustling place, no doubt, full of gossipy women as most of these offices were, all engaged in activities that meant less than nothing to her. Robin might not believe in a murderer. She knew that Strike did not believe either. But the process of proving one non-existent fascinated her. Robin had found the whole week more exciting than she would ever have confessed to Matthew. All of it, even calling Freddie Bastigui's production company Best Films twice a day, and receiving repeated refusals to her requests to be put through to the film producer, had given her a sense of importance she had rarely experienced during her working life. Robin was fascinated by the interior workings of other people's minds. She had been halfway through a psychology degree when an unforeseen incident had finished her university career. 10:30, and Strike had still not returned to the office, but a large woman wearing a nervous smile, an orange coat, and a purple knitted beret had arrived. This was Mrs. Hook, a name familiar to Robin because it was that of Strike's only other client. Robin installed Mrs. Hook on the sagging sofa beside her own desk and fetched her a cup of tea. Acting on Robin's awkward description of the lascivious Mr. Crowdy downstairs, Strike had bought cheap cups and a box of their own tea bags. "I know I'm early," said Mrs. Hook for the third time, taking ineffectual little sips of boiling tea. "I haven't seen you before. Are you new?"
"I'm temporary," said Robin.
"As I expect you've guessed, it's my husband," said Mrs. Hook, not listening. "I suppose you see women like me all the time, don't you? Wanting to know the worst. I dithered for ages and ages. But it's best to know, isn't it? Best to know. I thought Cormoran would be here. Is he out on another case?"
"That's right," said Robin,
who suspected that Strike was actually doing something related to his mysterious personal life. There had been a caginess about him as he had told her he would be late.
"Do you know who his father is?" asked Mrs. Hook.
"No, I don't," said Robin, thinking that they were talking about the poor woman's husband.
"Johnny Rokeby,"
said Mrs. Hook, with a kind of dramatic relish.
"Johnny Roke."
Robin caught her breath, realizing simultaneously that Mrs. Hook meant Strike, and that Strike's massive frame was looming up outside the glass door. She could see that he was carrying something very large.
"Just one moment, Mrs. Hook," she said.
"What?"
asked Strike, peering around the edge of the cardboard box as Robin darted out of the glass door and closed it behind her.
"Mrs. Hook's here," she whispered.
"Oh, for fuck's sake. She's an hour early."
"I know. I thought you might want to organise your office a bit before you take her in there."
Strike eased the cardboard box onto the metal floor.
"I've got to bring these in off the street," he said.
"I'll help," offered Robin.
"No, you go and make polite conversation. She's taking a pottery class and thinks her husband's sleeping with his accountant."
Strike limped off down the stairs, leaving the box beside the glass door.
Johnny Rokeby. Could it be true?
"He's on his way, just coming," Robin told Mrs. Hook brightly, resettling herself at her desk. "Mr. Strike told me you do pottery. I've always wanted to try."
For 5 minutes, Robin barely listened to the exploits of the pottery class and the sweetly understanding young man who taught them. Then the glass door opened, and Strike entered, unencumbered by boxes, and smiling politely at Mrs. Hook, who jumped up to greet him.
"Oh, Cormoran, your eye," she said. "Has somebody punched you?"
"No," said Strike. "If you'll give me a moment, Mrs. Hook, I'll get out your file."
"I know I'm early, Cormoran, and I'm awfully sorry. I couldn't sleep at all last night." "Let me take your cup, Mrs. Hook," said Robin.
And she successfully distracted the client from glimpsing, in the seconds it took Strike to slip through the inner door, the camp bed, the sleeping bag, and the kettle. A few minutes later, Strike re-emerged on a waft of artificial limes, and Mrs. Hook vanished, with a terrified look at Robin, into his office. The door closed behind them. Robin sat down at her desk again. She had already opened the morning's post. She swung side to side on her swivel chair. Then she moved to the computer and casually brought up Wikipedia. Then, with a disengaged air, as though she was unaware of what her fingers were up to, she typed in the two names. Rokeby Strike. The entry appeared at once, headed by a black-and-white photograph of an instantly recognizable man, famous for 4 decades. He had a narrow harlequin's face and wild eyes, which were easy to caricature, the left one slightly off-kilter due to a weak divergent squint. His mouth was wide open, sweat pouring down his face, hair flying as he bellowed into a microphone. Jonathan Leonard Johnny Rokeby, born August 1, 1948, is the lead singer of 70s rock band The Deadbeats, member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, multi-Grammy Award winner. Strike looked nothing like him. The only slight resemblance was in the inner quality of the eyes, which in Strike was, after all, a transient condition. Down the entry, Robin scrolled. Multi-platinum album Hold It Back in 1975, a record-breaking tour of America was interrupted by a drugs bust in L.A. and the arrest of new guitarist David Carr, with whom, until she reached personal life. Rokeby has been married 3 times, to art school girlfriend Shirley Mullins, 1969 to 1973, with whom he has 1 daughter, Mamie, to model, actress and human rights activist Carla Astolfi, 1975 to 1979, with whom he has 2 daughters, television presenter Gabriella Rokeby and jewellery designer Daniela Rokeby, and, 1981 to present, to film producer Jenny Graham, with whom he has 2 sons, Edward and Al. Rokeby also has a daughter, Prudence Donlevy, from his relationship with the actress Lindsay Fanthorpe, and a son, Cormoran, with 1970s supergroupie Leader Strike. A piercing scream rose in the inner office behind Robin. She jumped to her feet, her chair skittering away from her on its wheels. The scream became louder and shriller. Robin ran across the office to pull open the inner door. Mrs. Hook, divested of orange coat and purple beret, and wearing what looked like a flowery pottery smock over jeans, had thrown herself on Strike's chest and was punching it, all the while making a noise like a boiling kettle. On and on the one-note scream went, until it seemed that she must draw breath or suffocate. "Mrs. Hook!" cried Robin. And she seized the woman's flabby upper arms from behind, attempting to relieve Strike of the responsibility of fending her off. Mrs. Hook, however, was much more powerful than she looked. Though she paused to breathe, she continued to punch Strike until, having no choice, he caught both her wrists and held them in mid-air. At this, Mrs. Hook twisted free of his loose grip and flung herself on Robin instead, howling like a dog. Patting the sobbing woman on the back, Robin manoeuvred her, by minuscule increments, back into the outer office.
"It's all right, Mrs. Hook, it's all right," she said soothingly, lowering her into the sofa. "Let me get you a cup of tea. It's all right."
"I'm very sorry, Mrs. Hook," said Strike, formally, from the doorway into his office. "It's never easy to get news like this."
I thought it was Valerie,"
whimpered Mrs. Hook, her dishevelled head in her hands, rocking backwards and forwards on the groaning sofa.
I thought it was Valerie, not my own sister." "I'll get tea," whispered Robin, appalled.
She was almost out of the door with the kettle when she remembered that she had left Johnny Rokeby's life story up on the computer monitor. It would look too odd to dart back to switch it off in the middle of this crisis, so she hurried out of the room, hoping that Strike would be too busy with Mrs. Hook to notice. It took a further 40 minutes for Mrs. Hook to drink her 2nd cup of tea and sob her way through half the toilet roll Robin had liberated from the bathroom on the landing. At last she left, clutching the folder full of incriminating photographs and the index detailing the time and place of their creation, her breast heaving, still mopping her eyes. Strike waited until she was clear of the end of the street, then went out, humming cheerfully, to buy sandwiches for himself and Robin, which they enjoyed together at her desk. It was the friendliest gesture that he had made during their week together, and Robin was sure that this was because he knew that he would soon be free of her.
"You know I'm going out this afternoon to interview Derek Wilson?" he asked.
"The security guard who had diarrhea," said Robin. "Yes."
"You'll be gone when I get back, so I'll sign your timesheet before I go. And listen, thanks for..."
Strike nodded at the now empty sofa.
Oh, no problem. Poor woman.
Yes. She's got the goods on him anyway. And, he continued, thanks for everything you've done this week.
It's me job, said Robin lightly.
If I could afford a secretary, but I expect you'll end up pulling down a serious salary as some fat cat's PA.
Robin felt obscurely offended.
That's not the kind of job I want, she said.
There was a slightly strained silence. Strike was undergoing a small internal struggle. The prospect of Robin's desk being empty next week was a gloomy one. He found her company pleasantly undemanding and her efficiency refreshing. But it would surely be pathetic, not to mention profligate, to pay for companionship as though he was some rich, sickly Victorian magnate. Temporary solutions were rapacious in their demand for commission. Robin was a luxury he could not afford. The fact that she had not questioned him about his father, for Strike had noticed Johnny Rokeby's Wikipedia entry on the computer monitor, had impressed him further in her favour, for this showed unusual restraint, and was a standard by which he often judged new acquaintances. But it could make no difference to the cold practicalities of the situation. She had to go. And yet he was close to feeling about her as he had felt towards a grass snake that he had succeeded in trapping in Travailler Woods when he was 11, and about which he had had a long, pleading argument with his Auntie Joan. "Please let me keep it, please."
"I'd better get going," he said, after he had signed her timesheet and thrown his sandwich wrappers and his empty water bottle into the bin underneath her desk. "Thanks for everything, Robin. Good luck with the job hunt."
He took down his overcoat and left through the glass door. At the top of the stairs, on the precise spot where he had both nearly killed and then saved her, he came to a halt. Instinct was clawing at him like an importuning dog. The glass door banged open behind him and he turned. Robin was pink in the face.
"Look," she said, "we could come to a private arrangement. We could cut out temporary solutions, and you could pay me directly."
He hesitated.
"They don't like that, temping agencies. You'll be drummed out of the service."
"It doesn't matter. I've got 3 interviews for permanent jobs next week, if you'd be okay about me taking time off to go to them."
"Yeah, no problem,"
he said, before he could stop himself.
"Well then, I could stay for another week or two."
A pause. Sense entered into a short, violent skirmish with instinct and inclination, and was overwhelmed.
"Yeah, all right. Well, in that case, will you try Freddy Bestigui again?"
"Yes, of course," said Robin, masking her glee under a show of calm efficiency. "I'll see you Monday afternoon, then."
It was the first grin he had ever dared give her. He supposed he ought to be annoyed with himself, and yet Strike stepped out into the cool early afternoon with no feeling of regret, but rather a curious sense of renewed optimism. Chapter 6 Strike had once tried to count the number of schools he had attended in his youth, and had reached the figure of 17 with the suspicion that he had forgotten a couple. He did not include the brief period of supposed homeschooling which had taken place during the 2 months he had lived with his mother and a half-sister in a squat in Atlantic Road in Brixton. His mother's then-boyfriend, a white Rastafarian musician who had rechristened himself Shumba, felt that the school system reinforced patriarchal and materialistic values with which his common-law stepchildren ought not to be tainted. The principal lesson that Strike had learned during his 2 months of home-based education was that cannabis, even if administered spiritually, could render the taker both dull and paranoid. He took an unnecessary detour through Brixton Market on the way to the cafe where he was meeting Derek Wilson. The fishy smell of the covered arcades, the colourful open faces of the supermarkets, teeming with unfamiliar fruit and vegetables from Africa and the West Indies, the halal butchers and the hairdressers, with large pictures of ornate braids and curls, and rows of white polystyrene heads bearing wigs in the windows. All of it took Strike back 26 years, to the months he had spent wandering the Brixton streets with Lucy, his young half-sister, while his mother and Shumba lay dozily on dirty cushions back at the squat, vaguely discussing the important spiritual concepts in which the children ought to be instructed. 7-year-old Lucy had yearned for hair like the West Indian girls. On the long drive back to St. Maur's that had terminated their Brixton life, she had expressed a fervent desire for beaded braids from the back seat of Uncle Ted and Aunt Joan's Morris Minor. Strike remembered Aunt Joan's calm agreement that the style was very pretty, a frown line between her eyebrows reflected in the rearview mirror. Joan had tried, with diminishing success through the years, not to disparage their mother in front of the children. Strike had never discovered how Uncle Ted had found out where they were living. All he knew was that he and Lucy had let themselves into the squat one afternoon to find their mother's enormous brother standing in the middle of the room, threatening Shumba with a bloody nose. Within 2 days, he and Lucy were back at St. Maur's, at the primary school they attended intermittently for years, taking up with old friends as though they had not left, and swiftly losing the accents they had adopted for camouflage wherever Leader had last taken them. He had not needed the directions Derek Wilson had given Robin, because he knew the Phoenix Cafe on Cold Harbour Lane of old. Occasionally Shumba and his mother had taken them there, a tiny, brown-painted, shed-like place where you could, if not a vegetarian like Shumba and his mother, eat large and delicious cooked breakfasts, with eggs and bacon piled high, and mugs of tea the colour of teak. It was almost exactly as he remembered, cosy, snug and dingy, its mirrored walls reflecting tables of mockwood formica, stained floor tiles of dark red and white, and a tapioca-coloured ceiling covered in moulded wallpaper. The squat, middle-aged waitress had short, straightened hair and dangling orange plastic earrings. She moved aside to let Strike pass the counter. A heavily built West Indian man was sitting alone at one table, reading a copy of The Sun, under a plastic clock that bore the legend, Pucker Pies.
Derek? Yeah. You Strike?
Strike shook Wilson's big, dry hand and sat down. He estimated Wilson to be almost as tall as himself when standing. Muscle, as well as fat, swelled the sleeves of the security guard's sweatshirt. His hair was close-cropped, and he was clean-shaven, with fine, almond-shaped eyes. Strike ordered pie and mash off the scrawled menu board on the back wall, pleased to reflect that he could charge the £4.75 to expenses.
"Yeah, the pie and mash is good here," said Wilson.
A faint Caribbean lilt lifted his London accent. His voice was deep, calm and measured. Strike thought that he would be a reassuring presence in a security guard's uniform.
"Thanks for meeting me. I appreciate it. John Bristow was not happy with the results of the inquest on his sister. He's hired me to take another look at the evidence."
"Yeah," said Wilson. "I know."
"How much did he give you to talk to me?" Strike asked casually.
Wilson blinked, then gave a slightly guilty, deep-throated chuckle.
"Pony," he said. "But if it makes the man feel better, you know, it won't change nothing. She killed herself, but ask your questions, I don't mind."
He closed The Sun. The front page bore a picture of Gordon Brown, looking baggy-eyed and exhausted.
"You'll have gone over everything with the police," said Strike, opening his notebook and setting it down beside his plate. "But it would be good to hear first-hand what happened that night."
"Yeah, no problem. And Kieran Colovis-Jones might be coming," Wilson added.
He seemed to expect Strike to know who this was.
"Who?" asked Strike. "Kieran Colovis-Jones. He was Lula's regular driver. He wants to talk to you too."
"Okay, great," said Strike. "When will he be here?"
"I don't know, he's on a job. He'll come if he can."
The waitress put a mug of tea in front of Strike, who thanked her and clicked out the nib of his pen. Before he could ask anything, Wilson said.
You're ex-military, Mr. Bristow said.
Yeah, said Strike.
Me nephew's in Afghanistan, said Wilson, sipping his tea. Helmand Province.
What regiment?
Signals, said Wilson.
How long's he been out there?
4 months. His mother's not sleeping, said Wilson.
How come you left?
Got my leg blown off, said Strike,
with an honesty that was not habitual.
It was only part of the truth, but the easiest part to communicate to a stranger. He could have stayed. They had been keen to keep him. But the loss of his calf and foot had merely precipitated a decision he had felt stealing towards him in the past couple of years. He knew that his personal tipping point was drawing nearer, that moment by which, unless he left, he would find it too onerous to go, to readjust a civilian life. The army shaped you almost imperceptibly with the years, wore you into a surface conformity that made it easier to be swept along by the tidal force of military life. Strike had never become entirely submerged, and had chosen to go before that happened. Even so, he remembered the SIB with a fondness that was unaffected by the loss of half a limb. He would have been glad to remember Charlotte with the same uncomplicated affection. Wilson acknowledged Strike's explanation with a slow nod of the head.
Tough, he said in his deep voice. Why got off light compared with some?
Yeah. Guy in me nephew's platoon got blown up 2 weeks ago.
Wilson sipped his tea.
How did you get on with Lula Landry? Strike asked, pen poised. Did you see a lot of her?
Just in and out past the desk. She always said hello and please and thank you, which is more than a whole lot of these rich fuckers manage, said Wilson laconically. Longest chat we ever had was about Jamaica. She was thinking of doing a job over there, asking me where to stay, what's it like. And I got her autograph for me nephew Jason for his birthday. Got her to sign a card, sent it out to Afghanistan. Just 3 weeks before she died. She asked after Jason by name every time I saw her after that. And I liked the girl for that, you know. I'd been knocking around a security game for a long time. There's people who'd expect you to take a bullet for them, and they don't bother remembering your name. Yeah, she was all right.
Strike's pie and mash arrived, steaming hot. The two men accorded it a moment's respectful silence as they contemplated the heaped plate. Mouth-watering, Strike picked up his knife and fork and said,
"Can you talk me through what happened the night Lula died? She went out. What time?"
The security guard scratched his forearm thoughtfully, pushing up the sleeve of his sweatshirt. Strike saw tattoos there, crosses and initials.
"Must have been just gone 7 that evening. She was with her friend, Kiara Porter. I remember as they were going out the door, Mr. Pastigui come in. I remember that because he said something to Lula. I didn't hear what it was. She didn't like it, though. I could tell by the look on her face."
"What kind of look?"
"Offended," said Wilson, the answer ready.
"So then I see the two of them on the monitor, Lula and Porter, getting in the car. We got a camera over the door, see? It's linked to a monitor on the desk, so we can see who's buzzing to get in."
"Does it record footage? Can I see a tape?"
Wilson shook his head.
"Mr. Bastigui didn't want nothing like that on the door. No recording devices. He was the first to buy a flat before they were all finished, so he had input into the arrangements."
"The camera's just a high-tech peephole, then?"
Wilson nodded. There was a fine scar running from just beneath his left eye to the middle of his cheekbone.
"Yeah. So I seen the girls get into their car. Kieran, guy who's coming to meet us here, wasn't driving her that night. He was supposed to be picking up D.B. Mack."
"Who was her chauffeur that night?"
"Guy called Mick from Exec Cars. She had him before. I seen all the photographers crowding round the car as it pulled away. They'd been sniffing around all week,
because they knew she was back with Evan Duffield.
What did Bastigui do, once Lula and Kiara had left?
He collected his purse from me and went up the stairs to his flat.
Strike was putting down his fork with every mouthful to make notes.
Anyone go in or out after that?
Yeah, the caterers. They'd been up at the Bastigui's because they were having guests that night. An American couple arrived just after 8 and went up the flat 1, and nobody come in or out till they left again near midnight. Didn't see no one else till Lula come home around 1:30. I heard the paps shouting her name outside. Big crowd by that time. A bunch of them had followed her from the nightclub, and there was a load waiting there already, looking out for D.B. Mack. He was supposed to be getting there around 12:30. Lula pressed the bell, and I buzzed her in.
She didn't punch the code into the keypad.
Not with them all around her. She wanted to get in quick. They were yelling, pressing in on her.
Couldn't she have gone in through the underground car park and avoided them?
Yeah. She did that sometimes when Kieran was with her, 'cause she'd given him a control for the electric doors to the garage. But Mick didn't have one, so it had to be the front. I said, good morning. And I asked about the snow, 'cause she had some in her hair. She was shivering, wearing a skimpy little dress. She said it was way below freezing, something like that. And then she said, I wish they'd fuck off.
Are they going to stay there all night?
About the paps.
I told her they were still waiting for D.B. Mack. He was late. She looked pissed off. Then she got in the lift and went up to her flat.
She looked pissed off?
Yeah, really pissed off.
Suicidal pissed off?
No, said Wilson. Angry pissed off.
Then what happened?
Then, said Wilson, I had to go into the back room. My guts were starting to feel real bad. I needed the bathroom. Urgent, you know. I'd caught what Robson had. He was off sick with his belly. I was away maybe 15 minutes, no choice, never had the shits like it. I was still in the can when the bawling started. No, he corrected himself. First thing I heard was a bang. Big bang in the distance. I realized later that must have been the body. Lula, I mean. Falling. Then the bawling started, getting louder coming down the stairs. So I pull up my pants and go running out into the lobby, and there's Mrs. Bastigui, shaking and screaming and acting like one mad bitch in her underwear. She says Lula's dead, that she's been pushed off her balcony by a man in her flat. I tell her to stay where she is, and I run out the front door. And there she was, lying in the middle of the road, face down in the snow.
Wilson swigged his tea and continued to cradle the mug in his large hand as he said,
half her head was caved in, blood in the snow. I could tell her neck was broken, and there was... yeah.
The sweet and unmistakable smell of human brains seemed to fill Strike's nostrils. He had smelled it many times.
You never forgot. I ran back inside, resumed Wilson. Both the Bastiguis were in the lobby. He was trying to get her back upstairs in some clothes, and she was still bawling. I told them to call the police and to keep an eye on the lift in case he tried to come down that way. I grabbed the master key out of the back room and I ran upstairs. No one on the stairwell. I unlocked the door of Lula's flat.
"Didn't you think of taking anything with you to defend yourself?" Strike interrupted. "If you thought there was someone in there, someone who just killed a woman."
There was a long pause, the longest so far.
"Didn't think I'd need nothing," said Wilson. "Thought I could take him, no problem."
"Take who?"
"Duffield," said Wilson quietly. "I thought Duffield was up there."
Why?
I thought he must have come in while I was in the bathroom. He knew the key code. I thought he must have gone upstairs and she'd let him in. I heard them rowing before. I'd heard him angry, yeah. I thought he'd pushed her. But when I got up to the flat, it was empty. I looked in every room and there was no one there. I opened the wardrobe.